Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're all in one place.
We sure are.
Not only are we in one place, we are in the 1789 restaurant.
Drinking bubbly.
Drinking bubbly. What did you order us, Lauren?
This is Prosecco. It was the first bubbly thing I saw. Whatever.
It's either $100 or $7. We'll find out later.
She said, bring me all the bubbles in the land.
Well, we have a great deal of bubbles and a great deal to talk about, but before we get going, we don't have an interview today, but I do have like a unifying theory of the universe I'd like us to discuss.
Order. Is it about gravity?
It's not gravity.
String theory.
It's not string theory. It's about Muppets.
That tracks.
So many years ago, Dahlia Lithwick on Slate wrote an article about Order Muppets and Chaos Muppets. Mm-hmm. And she was ostensibly referring to the Supreme Court, which of course has been in the news this week again. But we are not that podcast, and so we don't have to talk about that. But Order Muppets and Chaos Muppets. And really the world is just divided into those two categories.
Can you explain what is an Order Muppet?
Yeah. So Radha and I are Order Muppets.
We are.
We spontaneously alphabetize things. Mm-hmm. We would like their Order Muppets may not necessarily themselves be particularly tidy, but desire there to be an order enforced by someone else. They could be the enforcer, but not necessarily. Then there are Chaos Muppets.
So I learned something about myself this week that was actually the most breathtakingly amazing moment I think I've had in about 6 months, which is that I am a Chaos Muppet who wants to be an Order Muppet. And honestly, the world makes so much sense right now.
Yeah, that's true. You 100% are a Chaos Muppet who would like to be an Order Muppet.
Like, I've given off the air of an Order Muppet for much of my career. But in my head, I know that my purse has like a banana that is about 7 weeks old. And I just have to get through the day.
So the key in any organization is to have an appropriate balance of Order Muppets and Chaos Muppets. Because if it's all Chaos Muppets, there's no cookies for anyone. But if it's all Order Muppets, no one's having any fun.
So let's think about our National Security Council. John Bolton, what is he?
I think he's mostly an Order Muppet, but it's a unilateral order.
Right. He's
an enforcer.
He's the Muppet. Eagle, whatever the eagle's name is.
Sam the Eagle.
Sam the Eagle. He's Sam the Eagle.
Yeah, I think that's
kind
probably
of angry.
That's probably right.
Was President Trump.
He's obviously a Chaos Muppet.
Right. But is he animal? Animal's too joyful.
Gonzo?
Maybe.
Ooh, yeah. Gonzo.
You can get some deep cuts on these Muppets here before too long. I'm apparently like Bunsen Honeydew, which we just all take that for what it's worth.
I think I was Rolf the dog.
Maybe.
There's nothing wrong with Rolf the dog.
There's nothing wrong with him.
He's
but
a
nobody's like,
person.
I want to go see the Muppets because I want to see Rolf the dog.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, Kermit's an Order Muppet.
True.
But beleaguered.
I mean, look, on the plus side, I always have cookies at home. So
you got that. So there's not really a grander piece of this other than everybody should go home and figure out if they, them, their spouses, their children, their parents are Order Muppets or Chaos Muppets and perhaps have a moment of clarity like Lauren did this week.
Indeed.
You're welcome.
So, moving on to how the world is falling apart in 39 ways.
The world is full of Chaos Muppets.
Chaos Muppets.
No cookies for anyone.
Chaos Muppets everywhere. Chaos Muppets. Listeners may remember from a few weeks ago when President Trump declared to everyone that North Korea was no longer a nuclear threat. And I think we might have been slightly skeptical.
No.
But were we right to be skeptical? What did we learn a few days later?
Yeah, we learned that we were right and he was wrong, which
shock. Which feels so good, but it doesn't really help anything.
I mean, it's true that that is one of my favorite emotions, to be right, but I would be happy to have been wrong in this instance. So as we keep up some foreign relations here, step one is Secretary Pompeo's trip to North Korea, which I'll be honest, I read the news, well, it felt like for several days, but it probably was just Twitter for several hours before I realized that he didn't meet with Kim Jong-un.
No.
He thought maybe he was going to. The White House indicated that he had planned to, but he totally got stood up. So that's like not great, but also not atypical.
But I think important to remember why he went over in the first place, which was that we learned from a public reporting that North Korea is continuing to increase their nuclear fuel program.
Right.
They did not shut it off. Not only are they no longer not a nuclear threat, they're actually becoming a greater nuclear threat. In progress.
There was some great open source reporting on that. Then it was leaked that there was probably a great deal of classified reporting on that, which we can, we just have to assume was shared with the president and certainly the Secretary of State at some point in the briefing process. And all of which goes to show that, one, there really wasn't anything of a great deal of matter agreed to in Singapore at the beginning of June, other than our public commitment to cancel military exercises, which has happened. The August or fall exercises have been canceled. But there was no commitment from the North Koreans to actually disarm. And I think here it's useful to kind of keep watch on these words, denuclearize, which isn't really a word and isn't really a policy, and disarm, which is a very specific sort of thing. So denuclearization is, I think Jeff Lewis has talked about it in the context of President Obama's Prague speech, long-term global aspiration of peace and unicorns and rainbows and the like. Disarmament's like a plan where you get rid of your damn missiles. And that's a very different thing. And right. We haven't made a great deal of progress.
Was this an I have a dream or is this a damn plan? I think it was by President Trump's indication that he believed he was signing a contract with his North Korean counterpart. This was more an I have a dream and we're going to have some follow-up meetings. Now, the big concern I have about this, like follow-up meetings and like clarifications, that's kind of normal out of this process. Like nobody was shocked that that needed to happen. But the fact that it had to rely on Secretary Pompeo is kind of big effing deal because he has a rest of the world job and is not the action officer for North Korea. And we can't just send them on a plane and cancel our big meeting with the Indians.
I mean, Kerry spent a lot of time in Vienna.
Yeah, and he did. He saw a lot of time where?
In Vienna.
Oh, I thought you said Havana. I was like, he spent no time in Havana.
No, he spent a lot of time
what
in Vienna working on the Iran negotiations.
He did. He spent a lot of time, and he also spent a lot of time in Israel working on the peace process. But actually, nobody thought that was the greatest idea, that like he actually does have a job to do other things.
So where does that leave us?
We need a process.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a little
and
bit like
officers.
When you need to
we have an ambassador
your,
now.
Well, that's something.
That's true.
With the
crazy mustache. Amazing stash. We had Alex Bell here on the show a couple weeks ago, and she talked about the fact that we need to have like a ton of State Department and Department of Energy intelligence community people who are working on this nonstop under an organized process to figure out how do we go over to North Korea and work out what do those definitions and details mean. And if that has to start with Secretary Pompeo, so be it. But it's got to be followed up by those hordes of wonks who want to define and measure and verify everything.
We don't seem to have that yet.
No. I think that there's still a lot of people they need to hire at the State Department first. They don't even
that
have...
That always goes super fast, so I can't wait for that to happen.
They don't have an envoy for North Korea. They don't have an assistant secretary for East Asia. I think we're lacking a few, even though we got the stash is now in Seoul.
Right. All right.
Delightful.
Next up on our KS Muppet tour of the world.
Brexit.
Brexit.
So yay.
So Boris Johnson might literally be a Muppet. I'm just saying.
You know,
he doesn't even need like to be assigned a name. He could just
that's
show
right.
up
he's
on
Boris
set.
The Muppet.
And
yeah.
He's Bojo.
You know,
Bojo.
Ready to
Bojo
go.
The Muppet.
Who is I'm Boris sure. Johnson?
He is the former foreign minister from the United Kingdom. So listeners may recall that in June of 2016, before Trump was elected and in a precursor to the beginning of the chaos order of the world, the UK voted to leave the European Union, but they had to like sort of figure out the long and technical details. Shocker. That wasn't done beforehand. The key bit is that regardless of what the details are, they're leaving March 29th. So
next year.
So they have now, I guess, about 6 months to figure out a bunch of negotiations on really simple issues like movement of people and goods and the border with Northern Ireland, which historically has been a peaceful and easy to resolve issue. So I think it's going to be great.
And to be clear, that's the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Correct.
And there's a whole separate set of agreements called the Good Friday Agreements. We've talked a little bit about those over the last few months that govern some of that. Meanwhile, Theresa May is the prime minister.
She is.
And in coalition government,
for
essentially.
For a hot minute.
We shall see.
With a Northern Irish party. Right.
Correct. She is with the Unionist Party who right. want to remain with the United Kingdom.
And to be honest, kind of a crazy right-wing unionist party.
Correct.
Yeah.
So she had put together this white paper that was longer than expected at 3 pages.
Wow.
Let's just be clear, friends. that was a proposed Brexit plan that was like kind of sensible and was a relatively soft Brexit that basically all of the pro-Brexiters thought was, you know, destroying the dream of Brexit. Side note, there's no dream of Brexit. But there's a nightmare of Brexit. And so On Monday, David Davis, the chief Brexit negotiator, and as mentioned, Bojo, our favorite foreign minister Muppet, resigned over differences with the prime minister, and a strong indication that there's a lot of lack of support within her own political party, which could mean there's going to be an election, perhaps a general election, a vote of no confidence on Theresa May, and a lot of uncertainty over whether anything positive will happen. So the deputy leader of the Labour Party, the chief opposition party, suggested that maybe we needed a referendum on Brexit again because it went well the first time. Theresa May told the parliament that they needed to prepare for a no-deal scenario where they just break up, but like no one knows what happens next, which I think the markets are really into, and also doesn't resolve the outstanding question of whether leaving the European Union leaves those Good Friday agreements and Northern Ireland border.
So it's kind of like breaking up with your live-in boyfriend but continuing to live with him more or less and share finances.
Or both moving out?
Until
or both
one day. Yeah. Until one day you're both living on the street because nobody could agree on when to pay rent.
Okay. I feel good about that.
Yep.
So one question for you, Radha. Is Boris Johnson, did he resign because he was like, I've had it with this, or is he resigning because he thinks I want to be prime minister?
That's a good question.
I'd say a little column B.
Okay, you know, that's reasonable.
You know, I was listening to a report this morning, like being British prime minister has pretty much been a poison chalice these last few years.
Right. I thought we were putting a woman in charge because it was so fucked up.
Right, but yes, that's exactly what we did. And, you know, we got here because David Cameron, I think it's always important for history to remember, was a craven shitheel and agreed to this referendum as a way of shoring up his right flank with the Liberal Democrats.
Right.
So, you know, the British political system is different from ours in many ways, including not having set executive elections. In fact, you can have snap elections, and Theresa May may find herself. She tried to call some last year. She did call some last year. They did not go very well for her.
She did not improve
her standing. She may find herself up for election again later this year if enough Tory members of parliament decide to call a vote of no confidence. But we have some similar dynamics of people doing things for kind of shallow or short-interested political purposes that have really dramatic long-term strategic consequences that they then kind of can't unask themselves from.
And a total and abundant lack of process while making major international decisions.
It's also, I mean, I don't want to sound like an elitist here, like doing major foreign policy decisions by referendum may not be the best expression of the political will. I'm just spitballing here, but perhaps that is not exactly how we want to run things. But meanwhile, Theresa May is having a week.
Elsewhere in Gotham City.
Or at least across the river, across the channel.
In the middle of all of this, she has to head over to the NATO summit in Brussels and their new headquarters. So it's actually kind of adorable that the world is paying attention to NATO summits because they are so typically boring that Robert Gates used to bring crossword puzzles to them in his big binder in order to do them during the meetings. Okay, so the Secretary General of NATO probably worked really hard on an agenda that he wants to talk through, but honestly, nobody gives a shit about the agenda because the big discussion of the day is going to be burden sharing, which basically, in Trump's mind, means are you paying more for NATO, all of my dear European friends? Now, folks may remember, I guess about a week ago, a little over a week ago, the president sent letters to a couple of his counterparts in Canada, Norway, Germany, and elsewhere saying, hey, spend more on defense, because we committed a couple years ago to have a plan to spend 2% of GDP on defense spending. And I have a theory about this that I'll get to in a minute. So Trump is obsessed with this. We've talked about this many, many times before.
He thinks NATO's a goddamn country club.
Right. He does. He thinks that everyone's paying dues. He doesn't understand what GDP versus a budget is. A whole lot of issues. So here's what I think is going to happen. I think NATO nerds, as they have been, are going to freak out and all start saying, like, well, if you counted it differently, and it's not fair because our economy grew and, you know, we actually deploy more and we don't have caveats and there's bigger and better things that we should be doing about measuring how much we contribute to NATO, and 2% is just not fair. And they're right in all of those counts. There's better ways that we could be measuring this. Kath Hicks had a good report about it last week and other people. But I think what Trump is actually going to do, if his advisors are smart, is take credit for getting this big $14 billion increase that he's had over the lifetime of his administration, and saying, look, you guys, I got more spending, even though I've been lambasting you before, now you actually increase spending again.
And the reason I think this is because, like, why the hell else would his administration send those letters? I feel like they're trying to, like, move the ball a little and say, like, hey, look over there, look over there. You sent those letters. You already criticized them. And look, they increased spending again. Am I being too optimistic?
I mean, that's rarely the case around here. I mean, it's certainly an optimistic view because he could do that.
Yeah.
And then insist they do more.
He could insist that he went up, do more. But wouldn't it be more fun for him to go into the NATO summit and say, look, I won. You guys spent more.
I feel like that, but, like, you know, the speech that he gave in Montana last week and his rhetoric around this, I mean, he just, you know, Tom Wright's been on this, you know, for more than 2 years at this point, which is just, you know, he thinks that we're suckers for being in NATO. And so even if they've increased their dues payments, right, and I honestly can't tell if he legitimately thinks it's run like a country club or he's just willfully portraying it in this way for his own purposes. But
okay, so here's my other option then, that, like, he's either going to do that and take credit for it and say we're going to win, or he's going to show up, kind of ignore everybody, and then show up at his Russia summit that we'll talk about in a few minutes and say, I'm pulling out of NATO. It's going to be one of the two things. He's not going to go and just kind of, like,
well,
play nice
to NATO. Thought.
yes, I'd just like
this
to...
This is actually the biggest question that I have right now.
And I would just like to say that among the many things that are conflated here is the president thinking that burden sharing in military spending is related to or in any way associated with trade deficits.
He has linked these issues in ways that previous presidents have deliberately avoided.
Correct. In part because these are our allies, and actually we generally think that these sort of trade imbalances have potential for other kinds of economic growth. But leaving that aside, as a fundamental issue when trading with liberal democracies, governments are only able to sort of affect the trade deficits through protectionist policies, and sort of absent the protectionist policies, actually basically consumer demand and producer supply that's generating trade deficits. So, like,
I'm sorry, I blacked out there for a minute.
I'm just saying, fundamentally, if we could just talk about spending the money on the militaries or trade between businesses and de-link the topics in terms of total money moving across borders, that'd be very helpful for the economists whose stomach hurt every time the president tweets and links the two together. That's all I'm asking for.
The other option I think our European partners have is to basically mansplain Trump. Like, well, you know, you're totally right about the whole 2% thing, but actually, and then come up with something totally random, bizarre statistic that is not related to this at all, and just spin him off on somebody else and get him pissed off at, like, Croatia or something like that because they'll win the World Cup. So basically, I kind of think this is going to be a shit show and I'm going to drink myself into oblivion every day, mostly because it's going to be followed up by an amazing meeting with Vladimir Putin.
If we transition to White House mayhem.
But Putin's easy. Wait, did that come out wrong?
So Trump's actually going to the UK on this trip as well.
That's true. He's going to UK before he goes to Russia. Do I have the order right?
I honestly don't know.
I'm not sure either. I know he's going to Russia after NATO, which
That's
is the
right.
most important part.
He's not going to Russia. They're going to Helsinki.
Oh, sorry. Yes, he's going to Helsinki. He's going to Helsinki after NATO, which is the important part. Because theoretically, you would want to have all the allies agree that, like, yes, Russia sucks, and show up in Helsinki. And, like, you'd say, like, yeah, I'm delivering a message from the allies. But it's probably going to be like, I saw the allies and it sucked, man. I wish you were there. We could have hung out. You could have brought me some prostitutes.
Yeah. So I don't know that we have any idea what the agenda is going to be, but it's definitely, I think, going to have similar optics to the G7 Kim summit sort of play-by-play, which was that there was this disastrous summit in Canada at the beginning of the month, as folks remember, followed by a very chummy kind of just effusive greeting and praise for one of the worst dictators, you know, in the world and a, like, discernible adversary of the United States. And I think we could see something here where there's, you know, a lot of kind of mumbling and grumbling and potentially sort of backstabbing at the NATO summit, followed by a really chummy meeting with Vladimir Putin. My only question is, like, what's the ask that the Russians have other than just sort of general?
Well, yeah, I think they have a lot of asks. They're going to this pretty weak. They need sanctions relief. Mm-hmm. They need to get out of Syria or have the U.S. get out of Syria so that they can get some of the funding from the oil coming out of there. They really, really need us to get off of their western flank, out of Eastern Europe, because we're kind of freaking everybody out there. They have a lot of asks. We aren't really showing up with any asks. So I have a feeling that, like, Trump is going to enjoy saying yes the way he always does. he's a people pleaser.
He really is. Yeah. And I think that that's an underestimated or underobserved quality of his in these, I mean, he has no interest in pleasing Angela Merkel, to be clear, or Justin Trudeau at this point, to be honest. But with other people who he holds in esteem, he wants to maintain their esteem by sort of the giving of gifts.
Right.
Well, and but the thing he esteems is what he perceives as strength, right?
That's right.
Which is basically being an autocrat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think being a masculine autocrat in that way. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe he would like Benazir Bhutto back in the day. Interesting question. Hard to say. Catherine the Great, perhaps.
There's some fan fiction to go out of there. Margaret Thatcher.
Wow. Well, thanks for that mental image.
Yeah. I was like, there's a lot of creepy stuff going on.
There's been a lot of White House mayhem sort of as of late, and we're not going to plow through all of it, but one of which is a topic that more on the Pentagon side, but that was in the news last week, which is the kind of immigrant citizenship program within the Department of Defense. Radha, what's the official name?
Yeah, Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest, or MAVNI. Which you guys may recall, we've actually talked about a couple of times
in
the past.
Because it's been in the mix for over a year.
Right. And it was launched in 2009. The idea was to get some people with key operational skills that aren't necessarily available or coming in high enough supply into our normal accessions process. That's the process by which people join the military. So these are translators, people with cultural expertise, but also medical providers.
Dentists.
Right. And so the programs 9-year history, there have been about 10,000 troops that have come through the program. In 2016, the Obama administration actually sort of paused the program and required additional background screening. So that effectively froze the program with the last new recruits entering in about October of 2016. So just before the Trump election. And about 1,000 people sort of caught in limbo where they joined and they had these screening requirements, so they didn't get out of this sort of delayed entry program and into their station.
And sort of separate from the MAVNI program in general, there has been a longstanding practice of immigrants joining the military for kind of accelerated progress to citizenship.
Correct.
And anybody who's served has served with Filipinos or Salvadorans or any number of folks from around the world who legally immigrated to the United States, joined the military, and have sort of this rapid citizenship process. So it's, I mean, I sort of find it quite extraordinary. Kai Rizdal talked about his dad doing this from Norway. So I don't know. It's I think, underappreciated from a lot of folks who maybe don't spend time with the armed forces. But it's not uncommon to have immigrants in your ranks.
And I think, part of the issue here was that the program itself, MAVNI, was set up without a real plan or process. So when they initially had it, they had about 1,000 recruits in. They increased it over the years to about 5,000 to meet a number of operational requirements that frankly never were met even by including them. But then they also needed to do all these background checks, which is like not an unreasonable thing and a thing we actually do to other members of the military when they're joining. But with foreign individuals, especially foreign individuals from places that don't have good official records, it's really hard to complete those checks. So you end up sort of in this system without a good process to deal with it in this sort of effective limbo. And I think Tara Kopp actually had a nice sort of rundown of the timeline and the numbers and the issues that arose. But, you know, essentially, you've got this bureaucratic problem that's kind of screwing over these people, married with an administration that has very strong anti-immigrant rhetoric.
I think there's a couple of points in here that were not terribly clear to folks who may have been following the story. One, that people who sign up for this program have not enlisted formally yet, but have signed up for the program, they may end up, due to the length of time it takes to do the background investigation, staying past their legal status, what had been their prior legal status of immigration. And then if they end up being discharged in any form that is not honorable, they can be deported at that point. And people who signed up via this program were not permitted to join the military for whatever reason, did not receive honorable discharges.
They get administrative discharges, essentially.
Right, and therefore may be subject to deportation, even though they had said, I want to join the military and serve my country in some form. So people are saying that this is not a Trump administration problem, per se. It is more of an administrative, bureaucratic problem. There's a number of things that DOD could have done to put resources against this, to better define its policy, to understand the population that it is trying to have serve within this, and it chose not to do so. So that's either incompetence or incompetence fueled by a little bit of Trump administration anti-immigration.
It's just hard to imagine this happening in this way under a different administration. I mean, this is where, I don't know, commander's intent or, you know, the broader political climate, I think, does play into it, which is that I just would kind of feel like Secretary Gates, Obama, President Bush, I mean, any number of folks would have been like, you know, let's do what we can to make sure these folks can stay and, you know, figure it out. And that figure it out mentality probably is why a little bit how we got here. There was a lot of like, well, we need them and they're great, so let's just figure it out. We kept kicking the can down the road. By the way, background checks are problematic for literally hundreds of thousands of federal employees at the moment on several different levels. And so we'd like to get that resolved more broadly. But certainly for folks with extensive foreign contacts and relatives overseas, it's a legitimate challenge, but maybe not the exclusive challenge. Right, Radha?
Right. So I'm just going to take the opportunity now to get on my soapbox.
Soapbox.
And talk about suitability screening. I know you guys are all wondering what on earth suitability screening is, and you may know and have heard us complain about the security clearance process, which frankly operates like a well-oiled machine compared to the suitability screening process. So if you work in the government, you get a bunch of different kinds of screening. Some of it is screening, so you get an ID card. In the military, those are called common access cards or CAT cards or other kinds of cards in the rest of the federal government. But to determine your appropriateness, regardless of whether you're in a national security position or not, you get this thing that's called a suitability screening, which happens under this federal regulation 731. There are a whole bunch of other designations on who's covered and who's not. But essentially, all of these processes rely on sort of the same set of information related to identity verification, which is roughly your ID and then fingerprints, a criminal history check, mental health and sort of like a drug addiction check, financial history, and then looking at intelligence risks, like Aaron mentioned, with foreign connections, designated group affiliations. And that piece on the national security positions is particularly important, but the rest of it actually happens for literally every government employee. So why am I telling you this? The bureaucratic stuff on MAVNI, it's basically actually the same bureaucratic stuff that comes up on clearances, comes up on questions on entanglements with business ties for Jared Kushner, right? When we talk about it in the context of security clearance with intelligence risks, but actually a lot of it is generated not by conflicts or really complicated issues, but by just lack of information and lack of process. So things like not all crimes go into the FBI database. This side note was a thing for the Navy Yard shooter, that not all states submit their information to the FBI database. Seems like we could fix that. Like, we don't have nuanced policies to think about foreign connections and the difference between, say, people whose family literally fled an adversary versus people who emigrated to the U.S. and have longstanding family ties. We have a centralized adjudication process that is hugely slow and inefficient, and we outsource all the investigations to contractors who've had a history of wide-range scandals. So in the end, we end up in these bureaucratic problems and sort of this backlog in the MAVNI that's really deeply harmful for these communities, but we actually have an overall problem with our background check process and suitability process that could be fixed by really straightforward things like improvement in our underlying processes, our underlying training, and then we can worry about things like continuous evaluations and complicated prediction models. But like so much of the screening discussion is really just solving interagency information sharing and bureaucratic processes that it just feels like if we had a will and people would just heart process, we would get there.
This reminds me, before we go to pop culture, this reminds me of the certificate of good conduct problems from the Jewish refugee crisis going into and during World War II, in mm-hmm. which the United States did not burnish itself very admirably and probably ended up killing hundreds of thousands of people, including Anne Frank.
Fab.
So pop culture, anyone?
So, having nothing to do with that, I have been finished reading Crazy Rich Asians, the series, which if you just need
an escape.
Did you
finish the whole season?
I finished the whole series in a day and a half.
Ooh, there's like three books.
If you just need an escape from the hellscape that is our world right now, this is a very good one. It's people spending an incredible amount of money incredible amount of money on clothes and then wearing them, or maybe not wearing them ever.
That's right.
There's a movie coming out too.
I'm very excited.
I also, on Lauren's recommendation, started this on the audiobook series and highly recommend it, if for no other reason than the combination of excessive spending and very posh accents.
Oh, well, that's a great... I'm going to London next week. So one, I'm super excited to see what the fallout is from all the drama this week.
But oh, God.
Excessive spending and posh accents is really, you know, in the wheelhouse.
Excellent.
There. I did the reverse of this, which was not posh or high spending. But HBO has a new series called Sharp Objects with Amy Adams, which is based on a Gillian Flynn novel. And so...
She wrote Gone Girl.
Which I read in a single sitting on a plane one time. It was a long flight to Tokyo. But similarly, I finished this in the weekend before the series started so that I could properly watch the series. Both are great. I mean, they're not happy places physically or emotionally. I mean, geographically or emotionally. But it's like a short run series on HBO this summer that should be pretty enjoyable. Some other folks have probably seen me rave about The Knicks. Which was, I found out the author was from Central Kansas, which explains a lot about why it was so emotionally resonant with me. And by emotionally resonant, I mean deeply withholding and, you know, not really emotional, but is a fantastic sort of multi-narrator story, layered, a Midwestern family. A lot of the action takes place in Chicago, both present day, but also the 1968 Democratic Convention protests. And so it kind of came out of nowhere. And I thought it was really great. And so for folks who read fiction, and that should be everyone, because we should all be reading more fiction, The Knicks is a very interesting read for the summer. Other movies? I'm behind on my movies in general. I did not see Ocean's 8. We're a little behind on the pop culture. I spent a lot of time at the pool this weekend reading. It was great.
I watched Mamma Mia on the plane because there's a new Mamma Mia coming out.
You felt like you needed to get caught up on Mamma Mia?
I did. So if anyone wants to come over to my house and have a Mamma Mia sing-along,
I do.
I'm there for you. Let's do it.
All right. Well, anything else here, ladies?
Oh, I guess we'll return to the hellscape that is our world.
We'll see everybody in a couple of weeks. Thanks.